We have top men working on it right now.
Who?
Top men.
Welcome back once more to Top Men Boxing Radio. I am Patrick Connor of The Fight City and some other places. Now, last week's show was another history podcast with my buddy Aris Pina, but this week, I'm all on my own again. The good thing about that, though, is that this shouldn't be a particularly long episode, and I should be able to cover a little bit more ground when it comes to previewing fights that are coming up this weekend and recapping the fights that happened last weekend. So, diving right in, right away, last weekend on HBO, middleweight titleist Gennady Triple G Golovkin made his West Coast return against Dominic Wade. The Kazakhstani middleweight wrecking machine improved his record to 35-0 with 32 knockouts by sending Wade to the canvas once in round one and twice in round two, the last time for the full count. We got exactly what most people should have expected from this fight, which was a decisive ending and an early night. Maybe the most unfortunate thing is that we had to wait 6 months since Golovkin's most recent fight to see him in the ring again, though having to watch him run over a guy like Dominic Wade was also unfortunate. But what did this fight mean? To be honest, it didn't mean a whole lot. We learned virtually nothing new about Golovkin or the situation he's been in for a few years now. Golovkin did exactly what he was supposed to have done against a foe that was overmatched. So he likely shouldn't be getting a lot of praise, a lot of pats on the back for his performance itself. What should be impressive is that Golovkin not only drew 1.3 million viewers on HBO, which happens to be the largest number thus far in 2016, but he got over 16,000 people to attend at the Forum in Inglewood, California. Many boxing history fans, or even just fans who have been around a while, may know the Forum as an absolute legendary venue for boxing. The last time Golovkin fought there was in 2015 against Willie Monroe Jr., and that time he got over 12,000 spectators. Neither opponent, neither Wade nor Monroe Jr., had much of a name in terms of moving tickets or drawing ratings, so he did that almost entirely on his own. I'm sure having Roman Chocolatito Gonzalez on both cards helped, but it goes beyond those two cards. His fight with David Lemieux got over 20,000 into Madison Square Garden, and he broke an attendance record at the StubHub Center for his fight against Marco Antonio Rubio in 2014. It just so happens that he apparently also broke merchandise records at both Madison Square Garden and apparently at the Forum. So those two things are also significant and kind of pointing in a certain direction here. Quite clearly, Golovkin is on the verge of becoming a significant star in the U.S., and the numbers back that up. Of course, the quickest retort to that assertion is that the pay-per-view against Lemieux did poorly, which is very true. But Lemieux is not a huge name in the U.S. either, and the broader point is that there really are only two pay-per-view sellers in boxing right now, assuming both Mayweather and Pacquiao have really retired. And those two pay-per-view sellers are Saul Canelo Alvarez and Miguel Cotto. Anthony Joshua is on the verge of taking over his local market and blowing up, but he isn't there quite yet. A few others are on the cusp, or they absolutely dominate their local market, but they don't sell pay-per-views like Canelo and Cotto can. Nobody else can. So that kind of brings me to a larger point. And while it's slightly more philosophical or even ponderous to try and grasp just yet, we may have to quickly start redefining the word superstar in boxing. I mean, this gives me a decent opportunity to give my own work a plug, but I wrote an article for Flow Boxing about 1 week ago that talked about this issue specifically. With Mayweather and Pacquiao either gone or on their way out, it alters the landscape of the sport. And it also means that someone is likely to fill their void sooner or later. This has happened before when big stars left boxing, retired, were sent packing by getting knocked out, whatever. There is obviously room for fighters aside from Canelo and Cotto to snag attention and make money. It just isn't apparent who that could be just yet. If Golovkin isn't there yet, it sure seems like he will be soon, though. However, it could be residual fallout from the Mayweather-Pacquiao pay-per-view fiasco, or it could be kind of the calm before the storm or something. But we may have to readjust what it means when fighters sell, what it means to say fighters sell well or do well financially. It has been about 1 year since Mayweather-Pacquiao, and rather than bringing a whole bunch of attention to the sport in a way that entices more fans or helps the sport really grow, many of the big sellers in boxing have done somewhat disappointing numbers in 2016 thus far, and even in the end of 2015. It's not to defend Golovkin at all, really, but it may be a while before we can expect any fighter to just automatically rake in anything approaching 1 million pay-per-view buys. And that means we could have to start consciously grading this stuff on a curve. But until Golovkin is given a fight by the lineal middleweight champion Canelo Alvarez, he may have to settle for being less than a superstar, but much more than your average ticket seller in boxing. In the HBO co-feature, as mentioned earlier, Roman Chocolatito Gonzalez defended the flyweight title with a hard-earned decision win over Puerto Rican banger McWilliams Arroyo. Over the first half of the fight or so, Gonzalez really landed some stinging combinations, and he showed why he's so highly regarded by a slew of boxing nerds and hardcore types that have followed his career for a while now. He moves really well, he throws frequently, he has good punching power and a good defense. But Arroyo was able to soak up that punishment, and he made a stand in a few later rounds of the fight. I don't think I'd say Gonzalez was ever actually in trouble, but there were a number of instances where he held on to kind of stem the tide, or when he was made to stop in his tracks by Arroyo every so often. It was almost a tale of two fights, and in the part that Gonzalez controlled, he was just more dominant. I will say, though, that Gonzalez looked like he was happy the fight was over at the end. One card read 120-108, while the other two scored at 119-109, but all three were just far too wide for my taste. They didn't accurately reflect that Gonzalez was made to work hard and actually dropped a handful of rounds to Arroyo. And after Gonzalez was pushed a bit more than we're used to seeing and didn't exactly have an easy time with Arroyo, there seemed to be some rubber banding when it came to opinions of Gonzalez as a fighter. Of course, this happens often when someone who appears flawless or easily earns wins over good fighters actually has a difficult night, but it can still be aggravating to watch this unfold. For starters, Arroyo is a talented fighter with heavy hands, and he showed he also has some intangibles like will to win, heart, and so forth. I wouldn't be surprised to see him give a lot of other flyweights plenty of trouble. Beyond that, this is Gonzalez's third weight class, his 45th fight, and he's only 28 years old. There's a lot of time for him to become whatever it is he'll become, and some time down the road, Arroyo could get another crack. The fight on Saturday wasn't one of Gonzalez's most scintillating to watch, but he remains a pleasure to watch, in my opinion. But as for Gonzalez's future, it's difficult to say who his next fight will be. A rematch between he and Juan Francisco Estrada would be fantastic, and there are rumors that HBO is interested in airing that fight, and that's great news, but Kazuto Ioka and Amnat Ruhenrong are two other flyweights that would be great opponents for the consensus best pound-for-pound in Gonzalez. But if the Nicaraguan were to be interested in moving up another division, there's a young super flyweight beast named Naoya Inoue who would likely welcome that challenge. The week was quiet otherwise until Wednesday, when long-reigning WBA super featherweight champion Takashi Uchiyama was dethroned by Jezreel Corrales by second-round stoppage in Uchiyama's hometown of Tokyo. It was indeed a shocking win, and especially for those fans who longed for Uchiyama to mix it up with the swelling ranks of the 130-pound division. But it was about as shocking to Uchiyama himself as the fight unfolded. What it looked like to me was that Uchiyama was surprised by Corrales' footwork, his kind of crazy angles, and the awkward style. And several times in the first round, he was stunned by punches that he didn't quite anticipate, almost as if he literally was just caught off guard by the guy in the ring with him. Then in round two, Uchiyama pawed with his right hand and left it dangling in the wind. So Corrales landed a left-hand bomb that just destroyed Uchiyama's legs. After going down twice more before the bell, the fight was called off and Corrales became the new WBA titleist at 130 pounds. It's not clear whether the result stemmed from Uchiyama's quickly advancing age and his legs just not quite being what they once were, or if he just overlooked Corrales and got caught unawares by a fighter he wasn't familiar with. It was a devastating loss either way, though, and we need to see Uchiyama get a win under his belt in a comeback before counting him among those players at super featherweight. But the idea of Corrales tangling with other 130-pound fighters like Francisco Vargas, Orlando Salido, Rocky Martinez, Javier Fortuna, and, you know, Jose Pedraza, that's a nice thought. And so it's nice to have him among those fighters, and new blood is always welcome. On to upcoming action, and the month of May should have plenty of it. But first, this weekend, the last weekend of April, brings us three significant televised cards on American television. Friday night on Spike, the famous, or possibly infamous, Durrell brothers fight in a co-main event kind of setup. I'm not even entirely sure which fight is headlining or taking the latest slot, but we'll get the brother that's, in my opinion, less watchable out of the way. Facing Australian Blake Caparello is older brother Andre Durrell, who is likely the more talented of the two brothers, but also far more afraid of getting hit. Unfortunately, Caparello is best known for unsuccessfully challenging Sergey Kovalev for his belts at light heavyweight, but since then he's moved down to super middleweight and is being given an opportunity to pull something off here. While I think it's highly unlikely, as I mentioned before, Durrell just doesn't like getting hit, and it's been obvious in several of his fights. He's also been in a few nearly unwatchable fights because of his aversion to getting punched. If Caparello can actually put a few nice wallops together, who knows what could happen. I do have to concede that Andre Durrell's last bout against James DeGale was actually entertaining, but that was nearly a year ago, and that inactivity could actually really hurt. Durrell's style is mostly predicated on speed and trying to stay elusive and or frustrating, but fighters with ring rust generally have issues with timing and movement, and lucky for Durrell, Caparello isn't the kind of fighter that's likely to take advantage of those things, but we should keep them in mind. Younger brother Anthony Durrell almost certainly has the more difficult opponent of the two in Caleb Truax. Both fighters actually fought on the same card about 1 year ago, and both lost their fights. This Durrell has been about as spotty as his brother in terms of activity, but in the ring, he's a bit more willing to mix it up, more willing to take a punch to land his own. He probably won't have to go searching for Truax, though, who's more of a hard worker than anything else. He's also a really nice guy, incidentally, and a great follow on social media, but he's a fighter who doesn't really do one thing really well. He's just good in most categories, if not somewhat average in the others. He's also moving up in weight, and he usually fights at middleweight and is facing this Durrell brother at 168 pounds. On his best night, Truax can probably stun Durrell or work up enough steam to land a fight-changing punch, but the odds are that he just won't be able to match Anthony Durrell physically. But no matter what happens in this fight card, the Durrell brothers aren't exactly the Galaxy brothers. Saturday, a bit earlier in the day, and on Fox, we get to see a rematch of what many voted 2011's Fight of the Year between Victor Ortiz and Andre Berto. Now, this is one of those fights where if you actually take it seriously, stop to analyze it and all that, it feels like you're missing the point of the matchup in the first place. It's like it wasn't that long ago that Ortiz was among Golden Boy Promotion's top prospects, but he picked up a handful of losses. He just hasn't been all that active. We all know Andre Berto's story. He was handed premium cable dates on a silver platter without having to actually beat top quality opponents for them, and that alone earned him a lot of criticism. But they're now both in kind of weird positions career-wise. Both have basically fallen from grace since their first meeting. Both have lost three times since that night, and they're just seemingly a fight away from getting put on some bigger fight cards. If we're being real, though, in 2016, both Ortiz and Berto are the kind of guys where we're just not sure what to expect from them. Either guy could win by knockout or decision, and it would make sense. Either guy could get disqualified for being an idiot, pushing the referee, whatever, it would make sense. An alien warship could swoop down from a parallel dimension, beam both guys aboard mid-fight, it would make sense. It's part of what makes them good television, and for the most part, we're just going to watch. So this is a fight where we can literally just sit back and enjoy it, however it develops. On Showtime, later Saturday night, will be WBC super middleweight titleist Badou Jack defending his belt against Lucien Boutte live at the DC Armory in Washington, D.C. This is a very intriguing fight, if you ask me, and I'm not really sure who to go with. Had Boutte not fought a surprisingly good fight against James DeGale this past November, I'd be really inclined to just roll with Badou Jack and be done with it, but Boutte fought much better than expected, and Badou Jack has never looked overwhelmingly good. Perhaps a crown jewel kind of performance will come against Boutte, but this is an intriguing fight because both men are vulnerable and both have at least respectable punching power. A few years ago, Jack was taken out in less than a round by Derek Edwards, who is mostly a journeyman or gatekeeper kind of fighter. But Badou Jack has rebounded nicely, and now stopping him is a known possibility, though. It can be done because it has already been done. The same can be said for Boutte, who was halted quite brutally by Carl Froch and survived real scares against Denis Grachev and Librado Andrade. Going on pure talent and athletic ability alone, though, Boutte might still be slightly ahead, even at 36 years old, and his prime clearly behind him. But sometimes that kind of slow and steady approach can win out in the end, and that's generally what Badou Jack brings. That this fight is for any sort of belt is probably more an indictment of the alphabet system than anything else, because several fighters are and should be ranked higher than both men at 168 pounds, but on its own merit, the fight could wind up being an evenly matched contest, if not exciting. But there's a lot more interesting stuff going on toward the top of the division's rankings, and the winner could potentially be in that mix. Also on that Showtime card, the aforementioned James DeGale, a super middleweight titleist of the IBF variety, faces Rogelio Medina, a Mexican super middleweight who is something like DeGale's mandatory for the IBF belt. DeGale was expected to face Jose Uzcategui, and that would have been a far more welcome matchup, but Uzkategi pulled out with an injury, so this will have to do. Medina is best known for stopping Jay Leon Love in 2014, but he's otherwise lost to every other notable fighter he's ever faced, and some not that notable ones as well. Maybe the most damning thing on his ledger, however, is a stoppage loss to a very, very weathered Luis Ramon Yoriboy Campos in 2011. So fully expect DeGale to send Medina packing so he can just move on with his life. Before we end this episode, just a few random news tidbits and notes to go over. As of a few days ago, WBO super lightweight champion Terence Crawford and WBC champion Victor Postol agreed to fight in July on an HBO pay-per-view card. I like this matchup a lot. I think most people probably do. It's a fight that makes sense at 140 pounds, and it's difficult to pick a winner right off the bat. My instinct says that Crawford is too fast, too skilled, too good. But Postol has tricky range and sneaky power. And Crawford might be dealing with ongoing legal issues in the lead up to the fight. For those who didn't see in the news, Terence Crawford turned himself in to police in Omaha over some damage done to an auto body shop that Crawford allegedly participated in. It wouldn't be surprising to see Crawford dodge charges or just get fined, but it's a distraction. Apart from that, it's just disappointing to see a guy like Crawford in trouble when part of his story is that he's a reformed knucklehead who got away from dumb things like that. Hopefully this is just a flare-up. But in other good news, following that matchup news, the following weekend, on July 30th, it has been all but etched in stone that Carl Frampton and Leo Santa Cruz will meet at Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. This is a great matchup. It's really tough to imagine Leo Santa Cruz fighting any other way but moving forward, and since Frampton took a more laid-back approach to fighting Scott Quigg than many expected, it's like a little extra insurance that there should be some actual exchanges. Frampton is moving up for the fight, though, and he might find himself having to physically push Santa Cruz off him. It's not as if Santa Cruz is a huge, experienced featherweight, but he's not small either, so this could get good. But lastly, Francisco Bandido Vargas allegedly tested positive for clenbuterol, according to an A sample of an anti-doping test. It apparently has no effect on his upcoming fight against Orlando Siri Salido, at least not until the results of the B sample come back. That, of course, opens the door to the larger discussion of performance-enhancing drug use in boxing, and the regulation thereof, of course, but I won't go into too much of a detailed diatribe here and bore anyone. If you want to discuss this issue, feel free to contact me in social media or ask me for my email, something like that. But the gist of my take here is that we aren't really testing top fighters as we could be. And even if we were, the punishment for positive tests isn't even consistent within the U.S., much less outside of it. Either test strictly and punish the positive results unmercifully, or lay off and stop testing for it. I know that's a very black and white view, perhaps, but the discussion about what we should be doing, about what we should be doing next with performance-enhancing drug testing and boxing, goes precisely nowhere, because there's no way to actually enforce many of the rules and punishments in boxing in general, much less for this specific issue. Again, I would be happy to discuss this away from the show, but for the most part, it's a conversation I've had too many times, and I don't want to rehash it again by myself here. And with that, the show comes to an end. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back as soon as possible with a great guest, and Aris Pina and I should be back also again with a boxing history podcast very soon. If you listen to us through iTunes, it would be greatly appreciated if you rated the show. And if you're on Twitter, follow me at Patrick M. Connor or Boxing History. If you're on Facebook, throw a like at the Top Men Boxing Radio page, if you please. Thank you so much once again, and take it easy, everyone.